Disclaimer. This episode represents the personal opinion of our host Martin El-Khoury. It is not the official position of Global Diplomatic Forum or the Good Governance Partnership.
We're here this afternoon to change the course of history. After decades of division and conflict, we mark the dawn of a new Middle East. Thanks to the great courage of the leaders of these three countries, we take a major stride toward a future in which people of all faiths and backgrounds live together in peace and prosperity. In a few moments, these visionary leaders will sign the first two peace deals between Israel and the Arab state in more than a quarter century. Israel, the United Arab Emirates, and Bahrain will establish embassies, exchange ambassadors, and begin the cooperate and work together so strongly to cooperate as partners across the broad range of sectors, from tourism to trade and healthcare to security. They're going to work together. They are friends.
Hello, everybody, and after quite a while now, a very warm welcome to a brand new episode of the Good Governance Partnership podcast. In today's episode, we are not going to speak about the COVID crisis for a change. After decades of supposed standstill in the negotiations between the Arab Muslim world and the state of Israel, something that was considered basically impossible has happened in the last few weeks. The Trump administration brokered a massive peace deal in the Middle East. Two Arab states, the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain, have decided to normalize diplomatic relations with the state of Israel. The UAE and Bahrain are now only the third and the fourth Arab country to make such an agreement with the Jewish state, the other two, of course, being Egypt and Jordan. This deal is going to have huge ramifications across the region, and the big loser, in my personal opinion, is going to be Iran. What came supposedly out of nowhere is in fact not that surprising. So, for instance, in 2018, I wrote an essay which is named Reinventing the Middle East. And there I have already advocated that the only way to really stabilize the region is to enforce collaboration and strengthen diplomatic ties between Sunni Arab states and between Sunni Arab states and the state of Israel. But how did this deal really happen and come to place? And which events led to this seemingly incredible outcome? And of course, the question that we always ask ourselves, qui bono and what comes next? That's what we are going to speak about in today's episode of the Good Governance Partnership podcast. Alright, so before we start with an analysis that really focuses on what is going on or what was going on between Israel and the rest of the Arab world, we should maybe take a look at the region to understand the status quo. So geopolitically and also socioeconomically to a certain extent, we have two, if not even three, different groups of states. One, we have the Gulf Arab countries, and these include Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Bahrain. In this specific case, I would not include Qatar, because Qatar, of course, is a Gulf Arab country, but is in a some kind of a formal conflict with the other Persian Gulf countries of the Arab world. So this is block number one, Sunni Arab oil exporting countries. They are basically defined by their tremendous wealth coming from natural resources, and also they can be viewed as the motors of this region. Then you have countries that are leaning towards cooperating or already cooperating with the second regional powerhouse in the region, aside from Saudi Arabia, Iran. And these countries, and I would to a certain extent also count Qatar to this type of country, are basically Syria, whose President Bashar al-Assad, of course, is strongly cooperating and depending on Iran for several economic and specifically security interests. You have the country of Lebanon, where, of course, there is a strong ties between the leadership of this country and the Iranian government. And then you have the country of Iraq, which to a certain extent is a special case, because depending on who is in power in this country, another, let's say, religious group is really represented. And religion strongly comes into play because to a certain extent, the interests of the different Arab states are strongly predefined by the religion or the religious tendency they have. So if you look at the Sunni Arab states, for instance, what you can very strongly observe is that the majority of those countries really, they are of course not officially cooperating with Israel, but there is talks, at least in an unofficial channel. We have been able to observe that in the last years when it comes to the rhetoric Mohammed bin Salman or Mohammed bin Zayed have applied when they spoke about the Jewish state. And on the other hand, countries like Syria, countries like Lebanon, and when I say countries, I mean the leadership of Iran, they perceive Israel as the eternal enemy. And let's say among all these states, we have, of course, Egypt and Jordan, who have officially already formalized peace with Israel, but are still part of this Arabic world, also part of the Arab League. And in between, you have the state of Palestine, or let's say the people of Palestine. And for the last 60 years, nobody was really able to find a solution for that. And this destabilized the region. So you have two major destabilizing factors, I would say. One is the conflict between Israel and Palestine. And the other one, of course, is the regional power struggle between Iran and Saudi Arabia. And those two countries are then again indirectly backed by big global powerhouses like Russia and China on the one hand, and of course the Western world and the USA on the other side. So what does that mean when we look at regional integration in the region? For regional integration, this really means that you have one overarching framework of regional cooperation, which is the League of Arab States. But this League of Arab States includes a plethora of different countries. So Qatar, for instance, who is to a certain extent a rival to the UAE and Saudi Arabia, is part of this League of Arab States. Syria, equally to Saudi Arabia, countries like Kuwait, countries like Egypt, is also part of the League of Arab States. And then, of course, you also have some African countries like Mauritania that are also part of the League of Arab States. So there really is no clear strategic tendency. And if you look at all the laws that have been made to, let's say, to enforce and to enable enhanced trades, enhanced foreign direct investments into this region, that always was very difficult because the countries themselves were entirely different and they pursued different economical and sociopolitical goals at the same time. And therefore, I was for quite a while already arguing that the only way to really stabilize the region is to make sure that there's one rather homogeneous bloc, and the homogeneity does not really come from the religion. I don't even believe that religion really plays this main major role that people always communicate, but I believe that most importantly, the economic interests need to be clear. And of course, to a certain extent, they stem from the allies that are backing the respective countries. Okay, so it stands to reason that an enhanced regional integration process within the Arab world immensely depends on how the regional actors deal with Israel. Because we know that Israel has been a country or is a country that in the eyes of generations of Arab leaders, both in the Gulf countries as well as in the Levante, has been viewed as the evil of the world and the major and single reason for foreign interventions in the Middle East, right? So there is a historically hostile position countries have. Now, these tensions are starting to relax. And the reason is that the historically hostile countries have come closer in their united fight against Iran, the united enemy, and Iran's allies. Just to give you a hint that this was basically not obvious, but there were some hints in the past already. So during his stay in Riyadh, US President Donald Trump said that Iran is the largest source of instability in the Middle East. That was in 2017. He called the international society to isolate Iran until the regime in Tehran is willing to become a partner of peace. This is a quote, Donald Trump, 2017 in Saudi Arabia. Now, during his visit in Jerusalem, he underlined this exact position again. It's also interesting to see that he is speaking about the exact same topic in two different countries and two different occasions, but this to a certain extent is emphasizing how important this Iran problematic is for both countries. And with this comments on Iran, the US president charged open doors, of course, in Tel Aviv and in Riyadh, because Tel Aviv perceives Iran as a threat to their existence and to their regional security. And Saudi Arabia perceives Iran as a threat to their regional dominance in the Arab world. And of course, also as a threat to, let's say, the predominance over the religion of Islam. So while officially there have been no official diplomatic relations between Israel and Saudi Arabia, it is quite clear that both countries might coordinate their secret services in their united fights against the Persian country and its allies. We were able to see that, for instance, when it comes to the conflict in Syria. There are some information, we will link the sources of course below, that the Syrian, that in the fight against the Syrian Assad regime and against the Hezbollah in Lebanon, there was some coordination of secret services between, let's say, the Saudi and the Israeli side. And according to several sources, Saudi Arabia even supported, and this is very, very much, and this is outrageous, basically, considering the hostility that they officially claim to have. They even supported Israel financially to sabotage the nuclear deal with Iran. And apparently this coordination has already deepened since 2014, when meetings of negotiators of both governments during a conference hosted by the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington were confirmed. That was in 2017. So, coordination, meetings, strategic communication between the two parties that officially are considered enemies have been confirmed already in 2017. And Council on Foreign Relations member Elliot Abrahams, a neoconservative, suggested that the US government should support this process of rapprochement. And actually, and we see that now, Donald Trump followed Abraham's wish, and Abrahams publicly expressed that he would prefer the conservative hardliner Ebrahim Raisi during the Iranian presidential campaign because, and this is very, very exciting, because Hassan Rouhani's presidency is threatening to divide the anti-Iranian frontier in the West. Like, why would you have a radical hardliner that completely opposes everything you stand for? Of course, because this hardliner is a stereotypical enemy. Hassan Rouhani wasn't. He had many supporters among the Obama administration. He had supporters and still has supporters in Europe. So it made it quite difficult for them to really advocate against Iran and advocate against this nuclear deal. And in the case of Saudi Arabia and Israel, such a division is very unlikely because they have existential, let's say, threats and fears that are directed to Iran. So unanimously, delegates of both countries condemned Tehran for its support of the Assad regime in Syria and other allies during the security conference in Munich in 2018. And the common concern over the Iranian enemy shared by representatives of the Gulf countries, Israel and Donald Trump, opens the option for a real coordinated cooperation between Israel and the Arab world. And this is not me saying that. That is a quote from Dan Diker from the Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs in 2017. Again, just to make clear that this was said a few years ago already, this opens the option for a real coordinated cooperation between Israel and the Arab world. We also know that Iran is the center of the axis of resistance, which announced its fight against Israel and is basically also represented by Hezbollah in Syria. This is no secret. Now, what has Saudi Arabia to do with that? Saudi Arabia fears the exposure of its hegemonic demands in the region. Interestingly, before the outbreak of the Arab Spring, leaders of this axis of resistance were very, very popular among the whole Arab world. So, in a survey, for instance, conducted by the polling agency Zogby in 2008, Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and former Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad were ranked on the first to the third position of the most popular heads of states. This is the 2008 annual Arab public opinion poll, by the way. Only 7%, respectively 1%, considered Iran or Syria the biggest threat in the region. This is the same poll. Israel led this category with 95%, followed by the US. So, this is 12 years ago, 2008, and a lot apparently has changed within these 12 years. So, the for me most interesting thing is that apparently still the majority of people believes that this hostility between Israel and the Arab world is still present today. And that is not the case. Because these numbers, combined with the events that we have just spoken about, really underline the shifting alliances that I have just stated. While the Palestine-Israeli conflict has been dominating topics of Arab politics for decades, the Brookings Institution attested a decline in favor of the Sunni-Shia conflict as early as 2013. The Washington Institute forecasted precisely that the conflict, which is especially stirred up by Sunni Gulf states, will become the central mobilizing factor in the Arab political life. The benefits for Israel, of course, in this situation, they seem to be quite obvious because the occupation of Palestine moves away from the spotlight of international discussions in this case. And the fight between Sunni and Shia seems to basically tear the Arab world apart. And this is what we're seeing right now. And as former Mossad chief officer Mir Dagan said, that opens unique opportunities for Israel. And I would like to argue that to a certain extent, what we see now with the first steps being taken between the UAE and Bahrain, normalizing relations with Israel, it's also a huge opportunity for the Arab world. But more about that later. So, especially considering the recent developments, and by recent, I don't mean the most recent in 2020, I speak about everything that happened between, let's say, 2016 and 2019, there is a lot of movement between the Sunni Arab world and Israel, and it's strong rapprochement. And it's interesting to see that this is really aiming at the Sunni Arab world, because it makes sense. I mean, if you look at who has already formalized peace with the Jewish state, it's two Sunni Arab countries. It's Jordan and it's Egypt. So in case we need any more hints that this has been basically in process, and this is why I was actually able to forecast that, because the hints were out there, let's see what we have here. So in late 2017, a TV interview on the TV broadcaster Al-Ra'i occurred between Fahad Saif Al-Ajmi and the journalist Abdullah Al-Hadlak, and they discussed how to improve Saudi-Israeli relations and how globalization can bring Israel and the Arab world closer together. What is special about that? This TV debate has precisely shown that the improvements of Arab-Israeli relations have already started to spill over to the public. 18% of Kuwaitis believe that the relation between the two countries should begin to normalize. One of the clearest hints for such a normalization process was provided by Saudi Arabia's Grand Mufti himself, Abdul Aziz Al-Sheikh. Al-Sheikh issued a surprising fatwa saying that fighting and killing the Jews was inappropriate. He also called Hamas a terror organization. This was in Al-Ra'i 2017. He called Hamas a terror organization. The Muslim ulama issued this ruling while answering a question on a television program regarding the Palestinian riots surrounding the Temple Mount in July 2017. This is extremely interesting. Al-Sheikh's words were warmly welcomed by Israeli's communications minister Ayub Kara, and he invited the Grand Mufti and head of the Saudi Arabian ulama to visit Israel. I mean, now it becomes obvious that the eternal hostility between the majority of the Sunni Muslim world and Israel is declining. We have seen that, there's hints, there's proof. However, That does not necessarily set the stage for an enhanced appeasement project process in the region, or even trigger a process of deeper regional integration, simply because Lebanon, Iraq, and Syria, three members of the League of Arab States, are very unlikely to adhere to this pro-Israeli position of Saudi Arabia. Now, Assad will most likely remain to his Iranian allies, since they are his strongest partners in the region and basically keeping him in power. And in addition, the new position Saudi Arabia seems to advertise might not necessarily be feasible for many Arab countries, including Syria. I mean, if we look at Syria, even under Hafez al-Assad's rule, they have basically justified their leadership with their hostile position against Israel, the US, and the West, and advertised their antipathy actively, and by these means tried to overshadow, let's say, their domestic policy failures, right? It is debatable whether Arab regimes are strong enough to change their position towards Israel while maintaining domestic stability. In addition, and this is also something that is going to most likely happen in the next few months, an appeasement process is logically very likely to be accompanied by drastically increasing tensions between Saudi Arabia and Iran. And this, again, would to a certain extent negate the stabilizing effect of the Saudi-Israeli reconciliation. But on a different level, because if we see this Sunni Arabic regional bloc coming closer together, cooperating with Israel, at least we have a rather homogeneous, alliance, which would probably allow for new economic chances, for foreign direct investments to flow in, for stronger inter-Arab coordination and cooperation as well. So it's going to be very interesting to see that, and we should not forget, considering that the US government, still a major stakeholder in the region, has taken a clear position against Iran, and taking into account that a Sunni Arab bloc that is able to coexist with Israel peacefully opens up great opportunities for collaboration between the West and the Sunni Arab world, it appears unlikely that a solution to integrate Iran in such a framework can be found, right? Such a process, and this is where all of that that is happening right now is really interesting, and that is a blunt guess, but such a process is only possible through common goals and development. And hence, it will be very, very interesting to observe which position Iran's allies, China specifically, will embrace within the Middle East in the future. Because if it continues to increase its influence, and I speak of China, if they continue to increase their influence in both Sunni and Shia countries, and we see that Iran, let's say Qatar, very much Shia dominated, or at least leaning towards Iran, and Egypt at the same time, the cards in the region can theoretically be reshuffled. And the US would not only be the only major stakeholder in the region anymore, and the Arab states would have to weigh out the interests of both the US and China. So while that might appear as a problem, it can also be viewed from a positive perspective. By embracing China as a major stakeholder, assuming that it increases its engagement with Iran and Gulf Cooperation Council countries, as well as other Sunni Muslim states, while ensuring Israel's security, which is guaranteed if there is, let's say, a formal peace, the Middle East would have a plethora of new options for international cooperation and for regional integration. Okay, now let's summarize. The hints towards a new Sunni-Arab-Israeli relation are undeniable. Whether this probably emerging alliance stabilizes the region or causes the exact opposite is a matter of how the major stakeholders approach the situation in the future. Saudi Arabian and Iranian relations are very likely to continue showing some increasing tensions and even fractures in the future. And the US withdrawal from the nuclear deal, of course, and its support for the diplomatic blockade of Qatar indicate that this is going to happen and that their stance against Iran is fostering dramatically. So we are seeing huge economic and also sociopolitical opportunities from this cooperation between Israel, UAE and Bahrain, and I believe many more countries to come. But at the same time, the question remains, how are countries like Syria, like Qatar, going to be integrated into such a framework of collaboration? Are they at all going to be integrated? And also, we need to look at China, of course, because China's increased engagement in the region, both in Iran and Saudi Arabia, might offer a way out because they are holding major stakes in both countries. Now, the American withdrawal from the nuclear deal, and I was very skeptical of that at the beginning as well, was viewed by many observers and also by many stakeholders as a, let's say, dramatic mistake. So German Chancellor Angela Merkel commented on the withdrawal thing, saying that it damages the trust in the international order. And I mean, we know Angela Merkel. For her, this is a unusually clear and direct reaction. Now, why different people, different parties, different politicians and stakeholders have been quite vocal about the exit from the nuclear deal, it seems like in the aftermath of this exit, things were happening that we were not really able to see. So somewhere in the dark, obviously, there was some negotiations between different and, of course, also major stakeholders in the Trump administration, in the administration of the Arabic kingdoms that were involved in these new negotiations, and of course as well within the Israeli government. Now, interestingly enough, it seems like that the exit out of this peace deal to a certain extent set the foundation to negotiate the agreements that we see unfolding now. And these agreements, I'm quite sure, will have some tremendously important impacts on the trajectory the region is going to take. Such a peace agreement between two Arab states and the state of Israel a few years ago would have been the major news. Of course, that might be also due to the fact that everybody is really struggling to deal with COVID, and that's totally understandable. But still, it is also very relevant for countries like Germany. So we have observed in Germany a strong increase of anti-Semitism most recently. And while people often say that this is, let's say, part of the German identity and part of the German ideology and therefore, let's say, a systemic problem, others, and rightfully so, observe that with the increasing number of Arabs coming into the country, there's also an increasing amount of anti-Semitism. This is a position where I don't have any proof for, but that makes sense because I know as a, let's say, as an Arab living in Germany, knowing the culture, that of course there are some prejudices against the Jewish people. And now if you have, and this is very, very important to mention, if you have MBS, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, and one of the big enemies of Israel in the past, stating that Israelis have the right to have their own land. He said that in 2018. You can look it up in Reuters. That says it all. That has also an appeasing, or let's say relaxing effect on how Arabs worldwide perceive the country of Israel and Jews. If we assume that Saudi Arabia has a strong power of mediating a certain worldview based on their position as the custodians of the two holy mosques, the chance is high that other Sunni Muslim states will follow this lead. So of course, while these developments are of course important and highly relevant, it's also a lot of work that is coming along with that. Now, in order to make sure that the collaboration is efficient and sustainable, Arab states will have to ensure that Israel's security is not threatened, for instance, by countries like Iran, Syria, and Lebanon, the direct border, right? And considering the geopolitical situation and the conflict with Palestine that is still not solved, of course, this is going to be one major task of the new partners. But, and this is what I would like to advocate for, what I'd really like to emphasize, cooperating with Israel is a huge advantage for the Arab world from an economic perspective, for several reasons. Among them, of course, the technological edge. I mean, don't forget that. Israel has tremendously close ties to the West, and its geopolitical location is highly interesting when it comes to trade. Israel could be potentially a very, very valuable partner for the Arab countries and the Middle East as a whole. All right, so this is basically a plethora of information in, let's say, quite a quick fire method. But I would just like to give you an insight on what has been happening basically in the last 5 to 10 years, or at least specifically in the last 2 to 5 years. So that these developments are not entirely new, and that it was something that we and observers should and could have expected, and we did so. So now, of course, and as usual, I would like to take this discussion and this analysis to the ki bono level, because I think it's always very, very important to discuss that one as well. And then we will arrive at the point of, let's say, justified criticism as well. But I would like to say one thing in advance. For every political thing that happens globally, every deal that has ever basically come into play and that was ever ratified by different parties, there is always an intrinsic interest that usually stems from some domestic policy reason. And if we look at the parties involved in these peace deals, it is quite clear what, let's say, the individual motivations and aspirations behind this deal are. So let's start with the United States. So the Trump administration has arguably failed coping with the COVID crisis. So obviously the number of infections are quite high, the number of deaths are quite high. And even though, let's say the mismanagement is both part of a national and a state level failure, President Trump has really made a very poor performance. I mean, regardless of your political position, there are many, many leaders who did better than him. And considering that the elections are just awaiting, basically standing in front of our footsteps, this deal, very important when it comes to showcasing his skill set as a deal maker in the Middle East. And honestly speaking, regardless of what we think about him as a president or as a person, what the US government has achieved here is historic. To a certain extent, of course, that is part of Trump's, let's say, election campaigns, if you want to say so. Like, he needs to deliver positive results in foreign policy, to a certain extent also to distract from the failures on a domestic policy level. And regardless of the facts, or if it's wrong or right, and this is not a discussion that I'm going to have now, the socio-political situation in the USA is also terrible right now. If it's his fault or not is another question. But people going on the streets and demonstrating, some of them even rioting, is obviously not something that a president would like to see in the United States of America only 1 month before the election. So him writing history is very, very important at this time, at the time being. Now, at the same time, Israel's President Netanyahu is facing a huge corruption scandal. So his position is arguably as weak as it has ever been since he is in office. And as prime minister, of course, being part of this historic deal makes him one of the, most popular and most important Israeli prime ministers in history, of course. And making peace with two major Arab countries, specifically the UAE and Bahrain, is one very, very important step. And I think on the other side, on the Arabic side, basically, the motivation is quite clear. It is very much a strong positioning against the threat that is coming from Iran and against basically their regional aspirations. And so much for the qui bono. Now, if we are here already, let's just continue with what most likely is going to happen and what I believe is going to be the case in the next months. So I think we are just at the very beginning. I even believe that this peace plan is already completely laid out and it runs on autopilot to a certain extent. I believe that other countries are going to join, among them Oman. Oman is going to most likely be one of the next countries to join this pact, to join this agreement. And others will as well. And I can imagine that it is communicated and negotiated in a way that the last and final country joining this peace deal, of course, is going to be Saudi Arabia. And I believe truly on a, let's say, societal perspective, this is going to be a huge thing. Because the antipathy among many Arabs and among many Muslims really loses, against Jews, of course, really loses the foundation once the custodians of the two holy mosques in Mecca and Medina announce peace with Israel. So this is something that is going to be tremendously interesting to observe. Now, what happens if really countries like Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, Iran, and Qatar are not interested in joining into this deal? If there is no solution to find peace? So first of all, I believe that there is a chance specifically, let's say, through informal communication channels between the American, US-American government and Iran, that something could happen on this frontier as well, which of course would be incredible and very, very difficult to explain at the same time. But I think it's unlikely. What I rather believe is that there is going to be some kind of a phase of transfer, basically. So you will basically observe that this Sunni Arab cooperation is fostering. You will have a stronger cooperation among these Sunni Arab countries that cooperate with Israel at the same time, and a new bloc will be evolving. And I can believe that this is basically the beginning of the end of the League of Arab States, and to a certain extent, at the same time, the new dawn, basically, for a new Middle East. And it's going to be interesting because countries like Russia will need to define their stakes. And if Russia, considering that there's also tensions between Russia and Turkey, of course, is rather to be put in some kind of this anti-Western, anti-Israeli bloc. But if Russia really supports this agreement, supports the cooperation between these Arab countries and Israel, then it might be possible that even countries like Syria could step into this equation. And this would set the stage for an entirely new Middle East. New in a sense that, considering its regional importance, its geographic importance, connecting the East and the West, connecting, let's say, Europe, the US with China, and the Southeast Asian countries, economically speaking, this is a unique opportunity for the region. And don't forget, like, it's not as saturated as other markets, right? So if it's possible to really foster growth and cooperation, to bring in Western capital, to ensure, let's say, regional cooperations between Israel and the different countries, I think this is a huge market that is going to surprise us in the future. And probably, I mean, this is a very optimistic view, and I know that, on what is going on. And of course, there is, let's say, the romantic Arab speaking from the bottom of his heart. But of course, that is an opportunity to really change the trajectory the Middle East has been taking in the past. All right, then. Thank you very much for your attention and for tuning in again. We will have an interview on this topic, hopefully quite soon. And of course, we will be back with many other different and interesting topics in the future. My name is Martin El-Khoury, and you were listening to the Good Governance Partnership Podcast. Take care and goodbye.